Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm! Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. With liberty and justice for who? Not Marissa Alexander. We have a lot to cover today. We look at Marissa Alexander's Stand Your Ground case. Are we truly one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all? We also talk about a federal lawsuit filed against a Florida school district, a reporter's comment about the Brooklyn Nets, and much, much more. First up, Marissa Alexander. Now, I don't know if you have been exposed to this information, but it is truly an interesting case. It's interesting for two reasons. One, it is in Florida. Two, because the same defense that George Zimmerman put up, Stand Your Ground, this young lady named Marissa Alexander put up the same defense for a similar offense. However, she did not kill anyone. She just fired a weapon. She discharged a weapon into an occupied dwelling, which was an interesting case. So let me break it down for you. Here's what CNN had to report. Marissa Alexander, a 31-year-old mother of three, is facing a mandatory 20 years behind bars. 20 years behind bars. She had pinned her hopes for freedom on a motion for a new trial. That motion was denied Thursday in a Florida courtroom. In late April, Alexander spoke to CNN as an inmate in the Duval County Jail in Jacksonville, Florida. She said, "This is my life I'm fighting for," while wiping tears away. "If you do everything to get on the right side of the law, and it is a law that does not apply to you, where do you go from there?" Now, Alexander is referring to Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which may be familiar to many of you because of the George Zimmerman Trayvon situation. But it is a law that has come under scrutiny since the killing of Trayvon. Unlike the Martins case, which involved one stranger killing another, Alexander's case involved her gun and her abusive husband. Now, on August the 1st, 2010, she said her husband, Rico Gray, read some text messages on her phone that she had written to her ex-husband. She said Gray became enraged and accused of her of being unfaithful. That's when he strangled me. He put his hands around my neck, Alexander said. She managed to escape his grip, but instead of running out the front door, she ran into the garage, she said, to get into her truck and drive away. Alexander said that in the confusion of the fight, she forgot to get her keys and the garage door wouldn't open. So she made a fateful decision. I knew I had to protect myself, she said. I could not fight him. He was 100 pounds more than me. I grabbed my weapon at that point. She went back inside the house, and when Gray saw her pistol at her side, she said he threatened to kill her. So she raised the gun and fired one shot. I believe when he threatened to kill me, that's what he was absolutely going to do. That's what he intended to do. Had I not discharged my weapon at that point, I would not be here. Alexander, however, said she did not aim the gun at her husband. She said she fired into the air, intending to scare him. And, of course, Gray quickly left the house with his two children. No one was hurt in the incident. No one was hurt in the incident. No one was hurt in the incident. But Alexander sits in jail facing a 20-year sentence on 3 charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Where is justice in this case? 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. Now, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but I just wanted to mention that Marissa is an African-American woman. Just had a baby, and she so happened to be accused of these 3 charges. Again, she fired a weapon in the air and did not hurt anyone. In contrast, George Zimmerman shot a man, and it applied to him. They would let him go free. 323-580-5712. 323-580-5712. I asked the question at the top of the show with liberty and justice for all. This is another Stand Your Ground case. Are we truly one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all? I need you to weigh in on this one. Now, another interesting story out of Florida was a federal lawsuit against a Florida school district alleged 2 black women who scored well on an adult skill test in 2010 were accused of cheating because they were told, listen to this very closely, they were told, you people don't score that high. The lawsuit filed in Ocala on April 20th and announced Monday by the Florida Civil Rights Association, which is representing Lila Jackson Birch, alleged violation of civil rights, defamation, and false imprisonment. Not only did the racially charged statement offend the plaintiff, the manner in which it was stated reveals a level of comfort and bigotry that is usually reserved for private embrace, the lawsuit states. Now, this report is out of Reuters, and Reuters is pretty credible, so here's what it goes on to say. FCRA President J. Willie David told Reuters that the civil rights group hopes to discover through the lawsuit whether a racist attitude is widespread within the Citrus County system in West Central Florida, where the incident occurred. FCRA President J. Willie David told Reuters that the civil rights group hopes to discover through the lawsuit whether a racist attitude is widespread within the Citrus County school system in West Central Florida, where the incident occurred. The lawsuit comes at a time of a heightened racial tension in Central Florida following February 26th shooting death of an unarmed black teenager, Trayvon Martin. Jackson Birch could not be reached for comment, A spokeswoman for the Citrus County School District said all executives were in a meeting and none returned a call for a comment. Then the lawsuit goes on and states that Jackson Birch and Aretha Thomas, who are relatives, took the test for adult basic education. It's called TABE test. An entrance exam for nursing school and other vocational training. Three administrators at the Willoughby Technical Institute in Inverness on Florida's West Coast accused the women of cheating, telling Thomas that they scored too high, according to the lawsuit. Calls for comment to the administrators named the lawsuit director Judy Johnson and the assistant director Denise Willis and Helena Degado, a test administrator, were not returned. Of course not. The lawsuit states that Willis and Johnson are white females and Degado is a Hispanic female. I don't know if this is relevant or not, but it's just the facts of the case. The lawsuit describes the alleged chronology of events. Willis explained the administrator's suspicion by saying, "You people don't score that high." Although no other evidence of cheating was produced, the administrators demanded the women return their test scores and retake the two-hour test. Jackson Birch refused and got in their car, but Johnson used her body to block the car from leaving. And they called 911. Subsequently, three deputies arrived, and Jackson Birch allowed them to make a warrantless search on their cell phone. Picture this. You take a test. You pass. You study for it. Pass with flying colors. Someone tells you, oh, you can't score that high. You people don't score that high. And then they tell you to retake the test, and you say, no, I'm not retaking the test. I took the test. I ain't cheat. You get ready to get in your car. Your administrator blocks you from leaving and call 911 on you and have your cell phone searched. That's what happened in this case. Now, in the subsequent sheriff's report, a deputy wrote that they found no evidence of cheating and that Jackson Birch believed the incident was racially motivated. What is going on in Florida? How does an administrator get away with this? What grounds can someone make a statement like that? You people don't score that high. I have no idea what's going on in Florida. All I can say is this. This makes no sense to me. It's time for a quick break, but when we return, we're going to open up the phone lines and take your calls. We want to hear from you. Stay tuned. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Faith Missionary Baptist Church would like to invite you to an evening of smooth, contemporary, and inspirational jazz on Saturday, May 19th, from 4 to 7 p.m. Performing will be featuring artists Joyce Spencer and The Expressions. Also performing will be A. Saint, Jazz Jr., Philip Brewer, and The Mustard Seed. This event is free. So bring your lawn chairs, blankets, and sunblock. Come out to enjoy the food, vendors, and great music. That's Saturday, May 19th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at 6710 Garner Road in Rowlett, Texas. For more information, contact Ladarian at hotmail.com. That's LADARIEN at hotmail.com.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my Eastbourne.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. In just a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. But first, joining me live in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer for TaylorMade Training and Consulting. I introduce to some and present to others, Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show. So, Jima, what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about this Marissa case because it's kind of bothering me a little bit because a stand your ground law states that a person may use force in self-defense when there's reasonable belief of threat. Now, of course, this applied to George Zimmerman when he shot Trayvon Martin, but for somehow it doesn't apply to Marissa Alexander when she just fired the weapon, she just discharged the weapon and didn't shoot anybody. What happened? What's going on here in Florida?
Well, it seems like Florida has taken our state of the week away from Georgia. And I guess because they're right there next to each other. But I think it's just classic. I mean, I'm not really sure what we, and in your statement you mentioned that no one got hurt, well, you know, maybe not by the discharge of her weapon, but the whole reason why she had the weapon was because the husband was abusing her. So someone did get hurt. Someone was already hurting the moment she felt like she had to leave the house and fearing for her life, only to realize, you know, she didn't have her keys and she couldn't get out, so she had to go back in. And she did what she thought she had to do. I mean, I can't understand how a woman who is being abused and trying to protect herself is the aggressor, is the victim, is not the victim, I should say. And
yeah,
husband who has abused, I mean, did he ever get arrested for the abuse?
Yeah, in the past he has. I mean, there's evidence that he have abused her in the past. I mean, this is not up for question. And then in the first set of questions that he was asked, he told them that he got five baby mamas and he hit them all except one. So it was not like there wasn't an imminent threat or reasonable belief of threat, I think the language says. Obviously, it was a reasonable belief of threat. So I want you to hear the interview in her own words of what happened and listen to the disposition that was obtained from RICO. This is crazy to me that the stand your ground law doesn't apply here. Moreover, that she's facing 20 years for not even hurting anyone. This is what's interesting. Again, I mentioned that she's a black female just because it's a fact, not because it had any bearing on the case. Take a listen.
She walks down the jail hallway in handcuffs. Marissa Alexander is facing 20 years behind bars, convicted of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. She says she was defending herself, standing her ground, from a husband who had been arrested before on charges of abusing her.
He was arrested for doing what to you?
He choked me. He pushed me forcefully into the tub. He pushed me so hard into the closet that I hit my head against the wall and I kind of passed out for a second.
Her husband received probation after that incident. Months later, Alexander says she was in the bathroom at their home here in Jacksonville, Florida, when her husband started pounding on the door. She says he was in a jealous rage over text messages on her cell phone.
He managed to get the door open, and that's when he strangled me. He put his hands around my neck.
Alexander got away from her husband and then made a fateful decision. She could have run out the front door and escaped. Instead, she ran into the garage, but says she did not have her car keys and the garage door was stuck. So instead, she grabbed her gun she kept in this garage.
And what did you think you were going to do with it?
I thought that I was going to have to protect myself.
Were you thinking you might have to shoot him?
Yeah, I did. If it came to that, he saw my weapon at my side. And when he saw it, he was even more upset, and that's when he threatened to kill me.
But how is he going to kill you if you're the one with the gun?
I agree. I thought it was crazy, too.
But why didn't you run out the door at that point?
There was no other way to get out the door. He was right there threatening to
kill me. What if he
would
have gone around him to go out the door? Your life would have been easier today if you did that.
Yeah, but the law states I don't have to.
The law she's talking about is the controversial Stand Your Ground law. Instead of running, she did what she thought was allowed by law. She believed she stood her ground and fired the gun into the wall. Nobody was hurt, but it was enough to scare her husband, Rico Gray, and he left the house with his two young children from a previous relationship. Alexander was safe from her husband, but not from the law. She was arrested, her Stand Your Ground defense rejected, and found guilty by a jury.
Marissa Alexander's husband, Rico Gray, agreed to do an on-camera interview with us to counter his wife's allegations. But a few hours later, he made the decision not to do the interview, claiming that going on camera would put his life in danger.
However, later, he sent us an email saying he would do an interview if he got paid, which CNN does not do. But he has already said quite a bit. During a deposition with a prosecutor from the Office of State Attorney Angela Corey and a defense attorney for his wife, Rico Gray acknowledged hitting his wife in the past and said this about the shooting incident, quote, "If my kids weren't there, I knew I probably would have tried to take the gun from her. I probably would have put my hand on her." Marissa Alexander's attorney then asked the husband what he meant about putting his hand on her. And Rico Gray responded, "Probably hit her. I got 5 baby mamas, and I put my hands in every last one of them except for one."
I believe when he threatened to kill me, that's what he was going to do. That's exactly what he intended to do. And had I not discharged my weapon at that point, I would not be here.
But later, at a court hearing to determine whether Marissa Alexander should get immunity based on the Stand Your Ground law, Rico Gray changed his story, saying he lied repeatedly in the deposition to protect his wife, claiming he did not threaten to kill her, and testifying, quote, "I begged and pleaded for my life when she had the gun." The jury deliberated for 12 minutes before convicting her. The Jacksonville NAACP wrote a letter to the trial judge saying Marissa Alexander may not have received justice because of her gender, race, or economic status. Some African-American news websites are saying much the same thing, that if Marissa had been white, her Stand Your Ground defense would have been accepted and she wouldn't be facing 20 years in prison. But Alexander will not say if she agrees with that possibility.
I'm going to be honest with you, I'm uncomfortable answering that.
For now, she sits in the city jail awaiting her sentencing scheduled for next week. She had a baby girl with Rico Gray almost 2 years ago, but she only sees her child in photographs. That's because Rico Gray has custody. He's considered the victim, his wife the criminal.
This is my life I'm fighting for. This is my life, and it's my life, and it's not entertainment. It is my life.
The 20-year sentence is a mandatory 20 years, meaning no chance of parole.
Man, this is, I just don't understand it. Jima, how did this happen?
Well, I think even more important than that, when you look at the jury, what were they thinking?
12 minutes.
I mean, right, 12 minutes that they deliberated and that they came back with that type of sentencing. I mean, did they not understand? I have even more questions for the jury. What were they thinking that her, what she did was so egregious that it deserves her losing out on 20 years of her life. I just find that appalling.
I guess what strikes me is odd that in this case that she didn't actually shoot Rico. She discharged a weapon in sort of a warning shot type fashion. It looked to me as if it was a gesture to say, stop bothering me. I don't want to use this against you, but if you come closer, I would. I mean, all those things that she tried to do to protect herself. you know, running out of the house, getting away from him. He had already put her hands on him. I mean, she was trying to get away, and she got her gun. She said, look, dude, leave me alone. And then she didn't even point it at him. I mean, granted, getting a gun, I mean, that whole situation shouldn't have happened, but since it did, she shoots in the air, not at him.
I know. That's why this is so hard for me to really wrap my head around, because I just don't understand how a woman who is a classic victim of domestic violence, who is only trying to do what she can to protect herself, finds herself on the wrong side of a jury verdict. And, you know, I'm more concerned about who was in that jury box that felt like her life wasn't worth anything but 12 minutes of deliberation. I'm saddened by that. I'm truly saddened by that, that even the police would arrest her even. I mean, you know, here you have a dead body with Trayvon Martin from George Zimmerman, and he doesn't even get arrested. And here you have nobody dead with Miss Marissa, and she gets arrested and goes to trial and is convicted. I mean, it's just, it's enough to just make you not believe in the criminal justice system anymore. I just don't understand. I'm not saying she should have had the gun and that she, you know, but nobody was injured. Cite her, give her a citation, a misdemeanor, but I don't understand. I just don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, all those things are right. I mean, are obvious, right? You know, you fired your weapon. I'm gonna give you a ticket, or I'll cite you for discharging your weapon inside the city limits, or a shooting into an occupied dwelling. Anything, with the exception of, I don't just see how you can get 20 years, face 20 years for this particular situation, and the fact that he's been beating her, he's admitted to it, he's been convicted of it, and they have history of it, and so all of a sudden, she, you know, gets to a position where she's enough is enough, and then now she's the one, she's the culprit, and he's the victim.
Right. I mean, it just seems so illogical and so unfair, and it's just, I just can't, like I said, I just can't seem to wrap my head around this case or the state of Florida at this juncture and how this law applies or doesn't apply. Because it seemed like it is so subjective, and that is based on the arresting officers at that point as to whether or not even charges would be filed. So it's, you know, and I'm sure she had some visible bruising, you know, or something from when he had attacked her that evening. So that didn't account for anything.
The common denominator in this case is two black people getting convicted, getting on the wrong side of the law. Let me put it in that fashion. Trayvon Martin and now Marissa Alexander. Both of them are African-Americans, and both of them on the wrong side of the law, and on different sides in this case. You know, Trayvon
right.
Martin was the victim in that case, and it, the law didn't apply to his, and it's not really beneficial to him. And then she tried to use the law to protect herself, and it's not beneficial for her. I mean, what do you do? I mean,
right.
How do you make a decision to protect yourself if you're an African American in a situation like that? Again, I pose the question: with liberty and justice for who?
I wonder.
You know, you're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So speaking of Florida, I mentioned earlier about this case where these people were, these two young ladies took a test, the TABE test, and then all of a sudden they get up to get their scores and they scored high, and it said that basically you people don't score that high. You people don't score that high. This happened again in Florida. What happened here?
Well, who are the you people, and how was this administrator having that much power where they're able to make such a statement to these students, and then they're able to call the police on these students, and subsequently the students go through this scrutiny from the police department of having their phones checked, which was illegal, but anyway, and... What, just who is this person? How does she have that much power? And if that's the case, if that's how they feel about our of students of color, then they shouldn't be in that position, because who knows how many other students they've done this to, and those students never said anything. See, cases like this, it's generally not the first time it's happened.
Right,
generally,
exactly.
It's not the first. Generally, they've done something like it or similar to it, or something just like it or similar to it, for them to be that comfortable that you can jump in front of a moving vehicle and tell them to stop and force them to take a test, to retake the test. And I know some will say, well, why didn't they just retake it? Well, why should I? Why should I have to retake something that I know I've studied hard for the first time? That's unnecessary. I'm not doing it. And I don't blame the students for saying, no, I'm not taking it. I'm not doing that again. You accept my score or, you know, the chips will fall where they may.
So here's what's bothersome to me, is the fact that the Trayvon Martin case was in Florida and it's questionable. And then we just talked about the Marissa Alexander case that happened in Florida, and it's also questionable. And now we look at this particular instance where people are saying you people don't score that high on this type of test. So it sounds to me that there's a cultural situation down in Florida in a certain pocket that is really toxic when it comes to dealing with people of color, specifically African Americans.
Oh, for sure. And the sad part about it is that this is none of the things that are happening for the first time. This is just the first time we're hearing about it, because if you go back to when all of the protests and things were happening and the town hall meetings were happening down there in Sanford surrounding the Trayvon Martin case, and the NAACP had that town hall meeting with the residents, and you began to hear the stories of things they've endured over the years of misconduct and neglect from the police department. What happened with Trayvon wasn't an isolated event in terms of the police and the police department and its practices. It's been going on for forever. And so this is just the case that got the attention. So I would, you know, if I was a betting woman, I would say a lot of the things that we're hearing about from the state of Florida and Georgia, excuse me, and other places, is that it's not just an isolated event. It's been going on for a while, and because no one ever said anything or didn't catch any traction, then people think that, oh, it's okay to do. See, people only do what they know they can get away with doing. So if I never go out and tell anybody that you have that what you just did as an administrator, or what the school is doing to my child, or that there's bullying going on, or things that, you know, my child is being mistreated, then you're going to think that behavior is okay. And it goes even back to the student. Was that in Virginia where the teacher told the student to talk blacker? I guarantee that wasn't the first time she'd made that statement, right? So it's not as these things are not isolated. They're just now being reported, and people are finally saying enough is enough. So we're hearing about it now. And the people that are the perpetrators are confused, because in their mind, they're like, but I've been doing that like that. But that doesn't make it right, because you've been doing it like that.
Right.
You know.
So how much do you think that social media, with the advent of Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Blog Talk Radio, all of these social media outlets, is bringing awareness to all of these crazy things, like you said, that's been happening all the while, but now they're just getting some attention?
I think it has a lot to do with it, because people from all over have access to Facebook and Twitter and whatever else. It's not something that's just for the elite, you know. It's not something just for the celebrity. So everybody has access to it. So if I'm reading something in a paper, excuse me, and in my little community, and it doesn't seem right, and then I tweet that to Roland Martin about, you know, this is what's going on down here, check out this story, then, you know, there it is. You know, it's reached not only Roland Martin, but everybody that's following Roland Martin. And so it seems, so that's how it is having an impact on hearing about these things. And then 24-hour news cycle, we are wide open. We see everything. And things are happening in small communities and somebody is tweeting about it or Facebooking about it, and then somebody else, replays what the other person said or reposts that, then it's done again, and then it's done again. And next thing you know, it's reached the level that it needed to reach to get the attention that it needed to get.
Okay. So I want to continue the conversation about another story that's, to me, in my humble opinion, is also racially motivated. But this one here is happened to some famous person. We talked about celebrities just a few seconds ago. Now, Phil Musnick writes for the New York Post, says some strange comments about Jay-Z, out of all people. Now, here's what he had to say. Phil Musnick said, as long as the Nets are allowing Jay-Z to call their marketing shots, what a shock that he chose black and white as a new team colors to stress, as the Nets explain, their new urban home. Why not have him apply the full Jay-Z treatment? And I don't know what the full Jay-Z treatment is, but here's what he explained it to be. Why the Brooklyn Nets, when they can be called the New York in N-words? He said, why the Brooklyn Nets when they can be called the New York N-word? You know what I'm saying here. This is what he said. Then he goes on to say, the cheerleaders could be the Brooklyn B's and H's. The cheerleaders could be the Brooklyn B's and H's. Team logo, a 9mm with hollow tip shell casing, strong beneath. Want to be Jay-Z hip? Then go all the way. Now, of course, this sparked a firestorm on Twitter. And you know, Twitter was on overload for the last several days. But Musnick fired back, and here's what he responded with after the Twitter firestorm ranted up against him. He said this. He said, that there has been obvious wishful and ignorant mischaracterization of his words. He said again that there has been obvious and wishful and ignorant mischaracterization of his words. Jay-Z profits from the worst and most sustaining self-enslaving stereotypes of black American culture. And I'm the racist? Some truths, I guess, are just hard to read, let alone think about. What do you think about his comments, Jimmy?
Well, I mean, this goes back to conversations we've had in the past about how we can't say one thing, and then when somebody else says it, we want to be all upset and highly offended about it. So, I mean, on the one hand, he's correct. Now, did he overly generalize and make it be all about Jay-Z? Yes, but, you know, you listen to Jay-Z, you know what the lyrics are, you know, in some of his songs. That doesn't diminish him as a rapper or as an entertainer, as a professional, because he's crossed over so many levels at this juncture. So that doesn't diminish, you know, what he's accomplished, but, you know, how he got started was using that type of language and saying those types of things. So we can't get mad at the New York Post writer for making that analogy, because it is true. It is a very true statement. Now, going back to the fact how he wanted to connect it to the sports team and you know, basically saying if you're going to have Jay-Z out there, then let's have the real Jay-Z. That's basically what he's saying. He's trying to say the Jay-Z marketing dude is a fake and phony because this is the real Jay-Z. Just listen to his lyrics. So, you know, he kind of calling Jay-Z out more than anybody about, you know who you are, you know, what you stand for really. I can't say I'm mad at him for that, because we do run around saying it. I mean, I see people's feeds on Twitter and I mean, even Arsenio the other night on Bill Maher slipped up and said the N-word. I know he probably didn't mean to, but, you know, he was just in the zone for a second, and he even said the N-word. So, you know,
okay,
we can't have it both ways. And,
granted.
And we keep trying to have it both ways, and we can't. And
granted,
the music
granted.
Industry has got to do something. It's the music industry and it's the comedy world Those are the two biggest entities that've got to make some changes with it. It's just the bottom line.
Okay. Great point. Great observation. Well, let me ask you this. Of course, he's not alone. There was another message on a roadside sign outside of this guy named Lanzo's Georgia Peach Oyster Bar in Paulding County, Georgia. It read, "I do not support the N-word in the White House." And this was on public display out so everybody can see this. He said, "I do not support the N-word in the White House." Now, I can see that used against Jay-Z because Jay-Z used it. But is it appropriate for him to use it against the president? Because there's no evidence that the president did it.
No, there's no evidence that the president used it, but it's evidence that he's comfortable enough in using the word because he's used it before. And unfortunately, this is not the first time that he's put some sign out there. Is this the guy in front of his restaurant or his bar or something?
Yep.
Yep. So this isn't the first time that he's done that, number one. So is it appropriate that he refers to the president as that? Of course not, because no other sitting president in the United States history of the presidency has ever been called such derogatory, demeaning names than this president has, period. I don't care how they try to shape it. No other president in history has been disrespected in such a manner, so people would say, well, they called George Bush a dummy. Okay, but when did dummy become derogatory and demeaning and inflammatory? It never has been. So you can't equate the two. And then George Bush did some things that, you know, were characteristic of someone not being very smart. So, you know. But on the other side of that, there's no way that a sitting president should have to endure the amount of things that this president has had to endure, period. I am so ready for when the next 4 years is up and it's 2016 and all these people out here talking about, you know, well, this is what y'all did to Bush. And I want to see what happens when the next white person is the president of the United States. I want to see what happens. I'm waiting for that. I'm so waiting for that because I want to hear all of this negative language. I mean, they won't even talk about Mitt Romney being a Mormon and what all it really means. They won't even talk about it. And he is a Mormon. But yet they talk about the president being a Muslim when he's not.
Right.
I mean, seriously?
Right. So let me ask you this then. So you obviously made a case for Mushnick using the word, but you made a case against Lanzo's use of the word. So how is it that Mushnick can use the word, the N-word, and Lanzo can't? Is it
no,
the context?
I don't think that anybody can use it. I'm saying we can't be offended by him equating it to Jay-Z's lifestyle, because this was all about Jay-Z. He wasn't talking about the players. He was saying if Jay-Z is in charge of your marketing, then Jay-Z needs to be in charge of your marketing like he markets everything else. That's what I got out of that. And on a small scale, he's right about that because of the lyrics in Jay-Z's music of the past. Now, I haven't heard anything recently. You know, I used to be a Jay-Z fan, and then I kind of lost him. I don't know what happened. So I don't really know what his new songs are talking about anyway. So having said that, I'm really not the one to be asking about Jay-Z. But I think the difference is that this person is using the term talking about the president directly. And even though it is that particular word, it is such an inflammatory, derogatory word that it should not be levied against the office of the presidency, period. Therein lies the difference.
Okay, point well taken. And with respect to Jay-Z's music, I mean, his music is still
you are the expert.
Hot.
I yield my time to you, sir.
You know, all respect due to his music now. Granted, your point to the fact that he puts the words in his song. Not only does he put it in his song, one of the titles of his new album, Watch the Throne, says in Paris. I mean, it's the N word in Paris. So, yeah, I see how one can associate that, but I still can't see how it's okay for Mushnick to make that to make that a accusation that he should be marketing his team in this hip-hop fashion when they're totally two different entities. You just can't – I mean, that doesn't mean that everything that Jay-Z does has to be in that fashion. And so, I mean, I think it's a blatant disrespect of someone to say that, you know, that he's using that term in his music, so he should be using that term in his business with the Nets. I just there's a false equivalency there, and I understand.
I agree with you. I'm not saying it's okay. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying I understand his analogy of using it and comparing it to Jay-Z. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's okay because I don't think it's okay for Jay-Z to use it. You know, period. I've just never been one to really associate with the word because of what all it carries with it. And you can say what you want to say, and that's a whole nother conversation. And words do have power. And we keep trying to depower that word. Words have power. Just like you want to, you know, they want to take away the power from saying the word slavery. People died. And so you cannot take the power away from that word. Words do have power.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The moment we stop trying to act like, oh, it's just a word, it carries something. When you call somebody out of their name repeatedly, and that's the only way you refer to them, that word has power. It has power enough to send somebody to go stand on a chair and hang from a ceiling.
Yeah.
So we have to be very careful in making these grandiose broad strokes that it's just a word. It's not just a word. It's a word with power. And so I'm not saying that I'm saying it's okay that he used it in that term, but Jay-Z has to take a step back and take a look at what have I done to perpetuate that this man would think that's okay. That's all. And he has to take a look at that. Nobody can clean that up for Jay-Z's image but Jay-Z or any of the other rappers that's out there right now. Nobody can clean it up or any other entertainer than them. They have to do that for themselves, but you can't get mad when somebody calls you out on it or causes you to pause and think about what you've been doing. So
you're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. If you just tuned in, we're joined by Jima Hill Cook, the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer for TaylorMade Training and Consulting. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, if you notice, most of the stories today were of interest to me because of this Black Studies critic's willful ignorance. And so all of these stories had a racial connotation because I wanted to bring them to bear because of this blogger's article that kind of is the tipping point for me for all of this bad rhetoric. And so most of the it was a Black Studies critic, Wilfred, and a blogger's screed is about politics, not scholarship, says Princeton professor. Now, NED writes, ignorance can be so loud and in your face that much we know it is a common feature of American public debate these days. Just turn on Fox News or listen to talk radio. But when it is willful ignorance, that is a deliberate refusal to assess evidence that contradicts ready at hand assumptions, it is beyond annoying and irritating. It leaves me angry, especially when crude and harmful views are hiding behind the ignorance. Recently, Naomi Schaefer Riley penned a screed about the state of Black studies. In a rather mindless blog, she dismisses the entire field based on a cursory glance at the dissertation titles of four graduate students mentioned in a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. She described the general thrust of their work as left-wing victimization claptrap, concluded that scholarship of Black studies was stuck in 1963, a rather arbitrary date, and that its primary mode of analysis, at least as evidence in the work of these students, was to blame the white man. Obviously, titles aren't the sole criteria to judge the quality of someone's work. I suspect, given her commitment to serious reflection, that if Riley were to take a close look at some of the titles of the dissertations written, say, in the fields of English and American studies, she would be quick to dismiss those disciplines as well. Maybe not, because behind Riley's mean-spirited engagement with that work of these aspiring young scholars lie the troublesome racial politics and black studies stands as its proxy. I raise this because I wanted to talk with Eugenia about her article. And basically, if you read her article, she says that their black studies should be wiped out. I mean, why should we even have that as a subject in school? She's basing this on four papers that she read, four dissertations that she read, and says, hey, this is nonsense. This is stuff that's stuck on 1963. She quotes the fact that if you look, we got a black person in the White House. Can't you see that? And she talks about all of these nonsensical things that should say black studies should go away because we got a black president, basically, right? And she gives the rationale because of these dissertations. So I want to talk to you about her article and see. And for me, does it compare to the Fox News reporter Neil Cavuto when he says poor Americans' ownership of refrigerators and other modern convenience should be proof that they are not suffering, or Newt Gingrich's notion that poor people have no habit of work? And better yet, Forbes contributor Gene Marks, when he wrote his open letter to poor black children, telling them that all things can do they can do if he was in their situation. So now she writes, Riley writes this, get rid of black studies, and telling them here's why, and as a white person. So how is it they can impose their feelings with such clarity on these minorities or in these minority topics with this degree of certainty? What do you think about that?
Well, it goes back to the whole time of when, as I stated earlier, unfortunately, these thought processes of these people is not new information. This is not the first time they've had that thought or that they've even verbalized it. The issue is that it is now being covered as a news story. Are we a little bit more sensitive due to the fact that we do have an African-American in the White House? Probably. But one cannot sit here and say that since this president and when he was running for office, one did not see the handwriting on the wall. I saw it. When you take a look at the fact that all of the people, the things they were saying during the primaries, coming to the rallies with Sarah Palin and John McCain with guns and showing up at different places with these signs and how they depicted him. No time in American history has a presidential candidate been depicted in such a manner on signs. You couldn't find me a footage of a George Bush general election, a primary, where such language and such things were being spewed about him. Nor could you say of Clinton or George the first Bush or even John Kerry when he was running. So we know it was all about race. We want to play like it's all about something else, but it's really all about race. So here we are with these people who now will have a platform to say this nonsense that they've always been thinking or what they've said just in a closed circle. Now they feel as though they have the right to just say it out loud because no one is going to really challenge them because we're so hypersensitive. When it's time to call something either racist or racial, we hesitate because we don't want to be the one to make the call. But some things are just what they are. So for her to make that statement and Cavuto to make the statement about refrigerators, that tells you that their mindset is sharecropper days. When we didn't own nothing, when the ice box was the big box of ice. You understand what I'm saying? When we worked from sun up to sun down on somebody else's land, and then they paid us meager wages because we had to live on the land. So if he's telling me that because I now have a refrigerator, I'm not poor, then that's just utter ridiculous for him to even make such a statement. But then that tells you how they feel about people, though. So they don't want us to be equal. Although when they say, let's, you know, we need to take our country back and go back to the tenets of the Constitution, I keep trying to remind people that it's because of the amendments that we can do what we do. It's not because of the Constitution. So when they make that statement, understand they're not talking about you. Anybody that's a female, that's of color, they're not talking about you because we were not included in the original Constitution. Our rights came with the amendments, and people forget that. So you want to stand and say, yes, let's go back, Mr. Representative Alan West. Go back to what? You wouldn't even been voted nowhere. You
know,
wouldn't even be able to stand on the floor and say some of the crazy things you say. So people's minds have forgotten history.
You know, I like that a lot because when you know, of course, we're going to get ready to shift to presidential politics here in a minute. And this is a great transition for me because President Obama, of course, he kicked off his reelection campaign over the weekend. And one of the major themes running throughout his language, his speeches, and throughout the physical cars in the audience was forward, right? Moving forward, moving in the future, looking ahead. And so all of the GOP's rhetoric is all about going backwards. I want my country back. Let's go back to a time when as you just mentioned, back in the day, taking women's rights back in the day. And the president is looking forward. So I really can, his message really resonates with me because it is a forward-looking message. It's a futuristic message. So I think it's going to be instrumental that he really continue to emphasize that because there's a stark contrast between the GOP's futuristic goals and of course, the Democrats.
For sure, for sure. I mean, it's as opposite as night and day, yes and no, in terms of their visions for the country and how we, as you stated, as the president is stating, that we move forward and that we and that we not go backwards and that we not look back. Those of us in the spiritual world, we know what happened to Lot's wife when she looked back. He told her not to. And so looking back means you can't see what's coming in front of you, nor can you be prepared for what's coming in front of you. Knowing what's back there is one thing, but trying to go back there is something totally different. And so we've got to be mindful of that. And so when you look at all these people, as I stated, making all of these statements and claims and declarations, and then as you stated, they say it, you know, with such vigor, like they're just so right, and that because they say it, it makes it so. And now they've come up, and for so long there wasn't enough other voices that were being heard that could challenge them. So they got away with it. Fox has been doing Fox for years. Fox didn't just start being Fox when the president got around. They have been doing that for years, and that's why they have such a strong following, because they've been doing it for years. Rush Limbaugh has been talking crazy like that about people for years. And that's why he has been able to get away with it, because wasn't nobody else paying attention but people that think like him, or nobody else had a platform to challenge him. Well, now there are other people coming out, the internet, blogosphere, people blogging. You can come up with your own blog and just write your own craziness out there sometimes. But then you can write your stuff that counters what these other people are saying, and that's an avenue that wasn't there before. So you're getting a different eye. And so when you get that eye, then you got to make sure that it's pointing in the right direction. And that's looking ahead and not looking back, because looking back will get you in trouble. And holding on, as the Republicans want to do and the Tea Party want to do, to the tenets of the Constitution, I've got to be smart to know that doesn't include me. And so because that doesn't include me, then I got to be vigilant about getting the word out, and it wouldn't include you either.
That's right. It's time for a quick break, but when we return, we're going to keep the conversation going. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Steamer, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
Our news in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Nicolas Sarkozy has conceded defeat to socialist François Hollande in today's French presidential election. Shortly after the last of the polling stations closed and with only partial results in, Sarkozy says he called Hollande to wish him good luck. Hollande is expected to have a major impact on the way Europe handles its debt crisis. In Moscow, an estimated 400 people are under arrest after rallying against Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Jessica Gallagher reports demonstrators took to the streets on the eve of Putin's presidential inauguration.
Chanting 1, 2, 3, Putin get out. Demonstrators streamed onto a square across the river from the Kremlin in one last show of protest before Putin's inauguration. The turnout for the rally was much smaller than the 1 million opposition organizers had hoped for. Last year, Russians took to the streets over what they say were fraud-tainted parliamentary elections and a corrupt political system. Putin has dismissed the protesters, calling them pampered youth and Western stooges. Meanwhile, opposition activists Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny are among several activists who were arrested for trying to deviate from the approved demonstration route and head towards the Kremlin. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's going to call for early elections. As NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports, the timing of the vote will most likely be tied to U.S. elections.
There's been a lot of speculation about why Israel's prime minister wants to hold early elections when his government has over a year left. But Sunday he announced that he will call for a new vote in the fall. The exact date hasn't been declared, but it's expected to be September 4th. Benjamin Netanyahu is riding high in the opinion polls and looks likely to get another mandate. Analysts say he wants to make sure he has a stable coalition in place before the U.S. elections. It's believed here that if President Obama gets another term in office, he will pressure the Israeli leader to revive the peace process. A newly invigorated Netanyahu, so the thinking goes, can withstand American pressure. Voters here are also worried about other issues too: Israel's economy and the omnipresent subject of Iran and its suspect nuclear program. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Tel Aviv. At Guantanamo Bay, lawyers on both sides of the case against five defendants in the September 11th terrorist attacks say it's going to be a long legal battle. This after a long arraignment yesterday, punctuated by several interruptions. Co-defendants occasionally knelt in prayer and refused to respond to the judge. Cheryl Borman, defense attorney for Waleed bin Attash, says she's going to push the court to deal with charges that he was tortured.
We have reason to believe that he has been subjected to mistreatment while in the camps, and we're hoping to address that with the court and hoping to get a fair hearing on that.
The military trial isn't expected to start for nearly a year. This is NPR News. Vice President Joe Biden is defending the Obama administration's economic record. On NBC's Meet the Press today, Biden acknowledged last week's job numbers show the economy is still struggling to recover, but he charges it will stall if Mitt Romney becomes president.
How is he going to create jobs? He talks about another $2 trillion in tax cuts for the very wealthy. You're going to create jobs? Is that how he's going to do it?
The Labor Department last week said the nation's unemployment rate slipped slightly to 8.1%, but analysts say that was due in large part to many Americans simply giving up their search for work. And as NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports, the unemployment rate remains higher for one group of Americans in particular.
9.2%. According to the Labor Department, that's the unemployment rate for American veterans who have served since September 11, 2001. The rate for these veterans is higher than the national unemployment rate, and it has generally been higher throughout the economic downturn. Compared with last month, the data show a 1.1% drop in unemployment, but the rate often varies greatly from month to month. The longer-term trend indicates a slow improvement in employment for these veterans, a group of about 2.5 million service members. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News, Washington.
Baby boomers and fans of 60s reruns, a cultural passing today. Actor George Lindsay, who played Goober Pyle on The Andy Griffith Show, has died. Lindsay's grinning, beanie-wearing goober joined the cast of characters after Jim Nabors' Gomer Pyle left the show in 1964. Lindsay was 83.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Well, it's time to talk a little politics. Now, not too long ago, President Obama officially kicked off his re-election campaign on Saturday by blasting the economic policies of likely Republican nominee Mitt Romney and arguing that Americans would be better off under four more years, guided by his own vision for the country. Jima, I really liked his kickoff this weekend. What about you?
Oh, I thought it was awesome. The president and first lady were definitely fired up and ready to go. They were excited about where we are at this time in history. They made some real good points about what he has accomplished and what's left to do. And he just seemed, in full campaign mode, like when he goes out there, he goes out there. And I felt real, real good listening to the fire in his belly yesterday.
You know, like I said earlier, I really liked the forward theme that ran through his speeches over the weekend. I primarily liked it because it is a direct contrast of the GOP's I Want to Take My Country Back, as well as the legislation that seemed to take the country back to the 1960s, where women and minorities had very little rights, as you suggested earlier. So I wonder, though, do you think the president is more of a – I mean, just looking forward for the next 4 years, do you think he's going to be more of a chess master or a pawn moving up to this new election campaign?
I think he's already been a chess master. I mean, you know, you just go back to this time last year and all that he was dealing with the crazy people from the right, with Donald Trump and the whole birth thing and all the people looking for the birth certificate. He does that. He goes to the correspondence dinner last year already knowing he had already issued the made the call to have them go in and raid where Osama bin Laden was. And then he comes out the next day and tells us that it's not only did we go in there, but we got him and he's no longer among us. So he did all of that. And in the midst of the adversity behind that, because people wanted to see the body, he didn't allow that to happen. He stuck to his guns. He buried the body at sea, which is custom, you know, for that particular segment of people. And he stuck to that. And ever since then, he has stuck to his guns. He gave up a whole lot what it seemed like. When you go back to the fight that was for the health care, which, you know, we both know, and hopefully our listening audience knows because we tell it almost every week, that, you know, that the fight for that wasn't just against the Republicans. There were some Democrats in there that held that process up as well. There were some people who were intentionally not getting the message out the correct way and allowed the right wing, the Sarah Palins of the world, to speak on these death panels and gave them such credence as though it was true. So he had all of that to deal with. And it felt like he caved when he extended the Bush tax cuts. And we was like, why would he do that? But when you look at where he sits right now, he sits in a daggum good position where he's made some lines in the sand that I don't think he's going to cross. And the Republicans are going to have to do something different if they want some different outcomes. You know, John Boehner said he thought they would probably, there was a 1 in 3 chance they would lose the House. And he's probably right about that. I totally agree. Now, having said that, I don't necessarily disagree, you know, with having different parties in power in Washington if they work together. If the Republicans in Congress would work with the president, a whole lot more could get done. So you hear them saying, oh, the recovery is slow. Well, the recovery is slow because you've blocked everything he's tried to do to move the recovery forward. But even in your blocking, see, this is how you know, and I think we talked about this last week. When you are where you're supposed to be, I think I was saying this as it relates to Michelle Obama. When you know you're where you're supposed to be, it doesn't really matter what the people are saying. So because they've made all these crazy statements, they put all these things out there about the president, about his policies, and he's still plugging along. And yet job growth is still going, you know. Stop the, you know, not losing 500,000 jobs as we was losing under Bush. We're gaining. And in the whole time Bush was in office, I want to say the number out is that he only created 2.1 million, and the president has already had 4.2 million jobs created. That's double what Bush did in 8 years, and the president has done that in 4. So don't talk to me about what he hasn't done. It might not, and some of the jobs that we lost would never come back. Some of those manufacturing jobs would never come back. That's the, you know, that's the unfortunate part. And you look at, you know, who his competition is right now, Mitt Romney, who doesn't have an original bone in his body or an original thought process in his body. So, you know, I'm waiting for the day. I'm so waiting for the day that the president is on stage with Mitt Romney and they're in a debate. I am so, that's something they could put on pay-per-view and could split the pockets because I'm so waiting for that moment. I thought I wanted to see it against Newt Gingrich, but having listened to this man get on TV almost every day and tell an untruth about this president and his presidency and this administration, I am so waiting for the president to call him out. I can't wait because it's obvious that the news people are not doing it. So the president is going to have to fight this battle by himself. And if I was a betting woman, I'd put my money on the president.
You know, you were talking about the economy earlier, and I was just thinking that, you know, those 4.2 million jobs that he created would even be higher, and the unemployment rate would be a lot lower had it not been for all those Republican governors slashing their budgets and cutting all those teachers and those firemen and those community helpers' jobs out. Remember when they went on this big rampage because they saw the writing on the wall. They knew the jobs were coming. They knew the private sector was creating these jobs. They knew people had – these companies had money on their books. So they started slashing these state jobs and these government jobs to really exacerbate the whole job growth component. So it would be a lot higher had we not cut all those teacher jobs. And I think he's working on legislation or some money vehicle, i.e. bringing the troops back home so he can use that money to fund these government jobs, again, for teachers and firemen and policemen. And I think we're going to see a major upspike in these jobs.
Well, when you talk about that, I mean, you know, a prime example of how, you know, your all politics is local, and what's happening in your state capital is having a direct impact on your numbers in terms of unemployment. I mean, I know someone that works in an office here who, and it's a state office, it's a city office, shall I say, and it's her secretary and the director, and she's responsible for 17, 18 cases of issues dealing with fair housing. So here we sit with one person that's in charge of answering these complaints, and that's all due to budget cuts. So there's only one caseworker, but she's in charge of that and everything else. So you're right. You know, they have taken state governments and all these Republican states and have slashed those state positions, which we know as well is a pathway to middle class. You know, some of those state jobs and city jobs and county jobs, you know, also paved the way for people to get in a job and stay there for a while and have some good benefits and be able to have a good retirement and be able to move up through a company, through the agency. You know, they slashed that. You have one person now doing five jobs, and we're wondering why we have such poor service. And in the area that needs the most attention, which is when you're dealing with people. And so you're definitely right that those states that fell under Republican regime are feeling it deeper in terms of some of their unemployment because of what the states have done with some of those state and county jobs by cutting police and teachers and firefighters and just county and state city workers.
And the other piece of that, I think, that is that you can't underestimate the fact that the fact that it's self-sustaining when a person has a job and they're part of the community, they feel some self-worth, they go out and they spend money and they invest, they make investment, their tax dollars are being generated throughout their local community. I mean, it's a major impact on the community when people cut jobs like that. And then the second part of it is necessary. It's necessary for you to have the right amount of teachers in the classroom to supply the needs of the students. It's necessary for you to have the right police based on the number of people in your community. It's necessary for you to have a fire department. It's necessary for you to have these government workers that you just mentioned. So I'm not real sure. I mean, the intent, of course, was to hurt the president. But you know, after that whole Bush tax cut thing, he had a new walk, if you will, and he started using everything that he had available to him to make sure the economy kept moving along when these Republican governors said, nope, we're not going to help.
And then I always wondered, who are these people who make the claim that the numbers aren't real? And I'm not saying that they are, but that the numbers aren't real because it doesn't include the number of people who just stopped looking for work. How do they know that?
But that number is factored in the overall numbers. These economists know what they're doing when they factor those in. So those people just don't know what they're talking about.
But that's what you hear though on the television. So like last month when the number went down and then the number of jobs was higher, you know, that was but that's not including the number of people. You heard it everywhere. I don't care what channel I was listening to, whether it was CNN, Fox, or MSNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC, it didn't matter. They all said the same thing. They all had somebody on there saying, but that number doesn't include the number of people that have fallen out of the workforce and that are just no longer looking for work. Every single station made the statement. And then here's the other thing. I thought one was less than two. Is that correct?
It is correct.
Okay, because maybe, you know, I'm a little challenged in math, but I always thought one was less than two. And so if you go from 8.2 down to 8.1, doesn't that mean that unemployment has gone down
That's correct. That's correct.
8.2
to
8.1.
Absolutely correct. Right. Absolutely.
So I don't care if it's half of a point, right? The fact it went from 8.2 to 8.1 says it went down. I don't care how you try to manipulate that and try to say that this is all because of the number of people that's no longer looking for work. That's a bunch of hogwash to me. And we know we are a emotional being. Humans are emotional. So everything we do 9 times out of 10 is based on how we feel. And right now, when people see 8.2 down to 8.1, they feel a little better about their day. You know, I may not have a job, but somebody else may have gotten a job last month that really needed one. You know what I'm saying?
And that's
and
encouraging,
so that's gonna
right?
Give, you know, that's going to give me a little hope that, you know, I might not have gotten the one I wanted, but I might have to just accept a job at this point and start to build myself back up again. So I think, you know, and that's what's been, all we need. And so they talk about they want to be funny and say, well, how's all that hope and change worked out for you? Well, that's all I've had to hold on to, and I'm still here.
Yeah, that's right. So let's shift now to Mitt Romney. Now, of course, the president has been, you know, jabbing at him, if you will. And it seems like to me that Mitt Romney is, you know, a carbon copy of everything that everybody wants him to be, right? I mean, there's no original thought that comes out of his mouth. There's no original vision or strategy. He's always copying somebody else's. He's always, you know, being the cautious person that says, "Yep, if the wind is blowing this way, this is where I'm going this way." And so every time that the President Obama does something, Mitt Romney tries to copy him. It's almost like you're copying me. So what do you make of this carbon copy phenomenon that Mitt Romney is doing?
Well, it's sad because if he doesn't have an original thought, then he'll be guided by any and everybody. So
specifically money, too.
Well, yeah, but if you go back to the fact that the night the president made the decision to go in, and you see the footage, you hear Joe Biden say, and you hear former President Clinton say, the decision was his to make. He had all the people around him feeding him information, but at the end of the day, he had to make the decision. And it may not have been popular with everybody in the room, but he had to make a decision. He had to think for himself based on everything he had, what was going to be in the best interest of the American people. And so he made that call by himself. I don't know if Mitt Romney has the fortitude to stare down a complicated decision and make one,
yeah,
or if he would defer to who's ever in the room with him.
Yeah.
There are certain times when you're in positions of leadership and authority, there is no one else to talk to but yourself.
That's right.
And I don't know if Mitt Romney has enough on the inside of him to make that type of decision. I'm not saying he couldn't. I question, because he does so many things based on which way the wind is blowing. He's changed on so many things, and he's changed on things that are near what I would say to the core of who he is. After all of this time, and I think this is something that Rachel Maddow says, after all of this time, Mitt Romney has been running for office for at least the last 8 years, I still don't know him.
Yeah.
You know, I still don't know what he stands for. I still don't know what he truly believes in his heart of hearts and the core being of who he is as Mitt Romney. After all this time, I still don't know him. That is a sad place to be.
Yeah,
and that's why it took his party, and they just kind of did it because they didn't have nothing else to do. There's no real love there with Mitt Romney, and they can fake and shake, and Michelle Bachmann can stand up and make all these asinine statements. I mean, she's just being who she is. But at the end of the day, there's no real enthusiasm to go run out and vote for Mitt Romney. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
was the last time, if ever, he drew 500 people, let alone 5,000?
Right.
You remember on the campaign trail when he had booked the whole stadium in Michigan, the Ford Stadium,
right.
And wasn't nobody in there but like 200 people?
Right. You made reference to something that I want to play. It brings new light to this commercial that Hillary Clinton put out a long time ago, right? Take a listen.
Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world. It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want answering the phone?
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
You remember that?
Oh, I remember it well.
And so, you know, I don't think anybody's going to question that about the president anymore.
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, you have now foreign national security experts, and I think they was on – it was somebody's show they was on today. I don't think it was Meet the Press. It may have been Face the Nation or – I don't know. But anyway, who has given the president the scores or the grades of an A and a B-plus as it relates to national security. So I'd say that's pretty doggone good.
So why is it then that people want to say that President Obama was spiking the football by talking about his successes in national security? Why were the GOP so hard on President Obama last week?
Because the president did something that they didn't do. The president said what he was going to do back on the campaign trail, and he did it. He said, I will look for him, and I will find him. And when I find him, there's going to be one or two choices. He will either be captured or he will be killed. And he meant that. And that's exactly what he did. The problem is the president didn't spike the ball or do all that nonsense they keep talking about. Bush landed on a daggum aircraft carrier. Talk about mission accomplished. And what had we accomplished?
Right,
we
right.
just got out of the war in Iraq. Hello? So what mission was accomplished? And the president said he was going to do that, and he did it. So he said we were in the war in Iraq, and we have. He said we would be pulling our troops out of Iran, and we will. Afghanistan, and we will. I believe him on that. I do. And so because he did it and how he did it, and this is what I said. I think I blogged about this week. Their main problem was he had all those they thought they were going to be a distraction with the noise they were coming up with, the nonsense they were coming. They kept coming up with crazy stuff, you know, dealing with the health care. And then they wanted to hold them hostage to the Bush tax cuts. And then they wanted to hold them hostage with the debt ceiling. And then everything they threw at him. And at the whole time, he's planning to take out Bin Laden, period. Because that was an 8-month ordeal where they planned it down to the T. And so you don't wake up one morning and say, okay, let's go do this. You know, your
right.
people got to be trained, and they have to go through the necessary exercises to make it happen. And so he put that out. We going to go find him. George Bush said, I don't have time to be looking for him. So they stopped looking for him.
Right, right.
Okay, so how can you give credit to somebody for doing something when they weren't even looking for him no more? When George Bush left office, we were no longer looking for Osama bin Laden, period. So the fact of the matter is we know if a Republican, I mean, let's just go back. When George Bush ran for re-election, and let's talk about why they call Rudy Giuliani America's mayor. That's all because every other word out of their mouths was 9/11. 9/11 this, 9/11 that. Let's not forget how they used that fear of 9/11 for all of them to get elected and or reelected. About what happened on my watch and going after Saddam Hussein, who had absolutely nothing to do with what happened on 9/11. That was a spiking of the ball. Was that fiasco
that
had nothing to do with nothing?
So let's pause for a minute and talk about the criticality of the second presidential term. Now, we know that it was critical for us to have the first African-American in the White House, and we know how important it was for the legacy of America, really. I mean, we know it was important for the legacy of African-Americans, but it's also just as important for the legacy of America. How important do you think it is is it that he gets a second term? Because we know that history judge presidents based on their ability to get reelected, right? Out of all the wonderful things that we know the president has done, all the major legislation that he's moved forward, all of the monumental events he's been a part of, it would all be for naught if he doesn't get a second term. So for you, what does it mean that we make sure that he gets a second term?
Well, it's for all of what you just said, because we know what history will say. Although he has done a lot of great things, it would not be as kind if he's only given a one term. And so we have to ensure that he gets a second term to be able to finish what's in his plan. So he's only just now getting started. And when you talk about some of the things that are on the horizon looking forward, and the things around education and jobs for our veterans returning, and we know all of that is going to happen. This president is not going to commit us to another war unnecessarily. So eventually those veterans will be coming back, and they're going to need help. They're going to need jobs. They're going to need places to stay. They're going to need mental health crisis intervention. They're going to need all that. Their kids are going to need, they're going to need places to live. So all of those things is what he is trying to infuse into our system right now. So, you know, he has to get a second term, because if not, all of that will halt. Because I guarantee you, if a Republican gets back in office right now, there would, we would be in a war in 6 months. I believe that. I believe that. I'm serious. By the spring of 2013, if there is a Republican office, I guarantee. Okay, you laughing. I guarantee you, we'll be in a war somewhere.
All the money is going towards war. That's why we can't really do anything here, because of the money is always sent abroad, and they're spending in those contracts they be giving those people over there, those defense contractors. So, you know, when you keep spending money in those conflicts, it's very hard to spend money for a domestic agenda.
Right, because you don't have any. I mean, it's the same for the same pile of money is there. That's why you have to generate income. You generate income by raising taxes, right? That's one way you can generate income. That's one way to bridge the gap between what we need and what we have, is to let's get a little bit more coming in. Let's cut some spending on some other things, but we just can't cut and not bring in nothing. You still got to bring in something, because you'll find yourself cutting off your toe by the time it's all said and done, because you're still not – Your mortgage is still going to be your same mortgage. Your mortgage is not going to go down because,
right.
I mean, you know what I'm saying?
It's
just not going to happen like that. Every bill you have that's a needed bill, your mortgage, your car payment, your life insurance, your kids' tuition, whatever you, all those things, your lights, your gas, and your food, all those things you have to do. You have to do that. And so you have to have enough to still cover that. I don't care what all you cut, you still got to have enough to cover that. So you got to raise some more money. You got to bring in some more funds. And so that's what the president is saying. If we cut everything and cut out everything, with the amount of people going into retirement, you need that much more money to put into it, into Social Security, so that people can have it when it's time for them to need it.
And you can't do that
just through cuts. You can't do it.
Another problem that we've had over the last several years is the fact that those jobs that were shipped, and not just jobs, good paying jobs, paying high quality taxes, and not to mention there were people that were willing to pay their taxes, those jobs were shipped overseas, and now that they're overseas, that core money, core dollar amount is no longer coming back, right? So although we had a taxation policy in place that was sufficient at the time, it's no longer relevant now because we don't have that dollar. There's a gaping hole when you shift the jobs overseas. There's a gaping hole now where all of the jobs were lost. So although we have gained a large portion of those jobs, there's still a remaining hole that those jobs that were shipped overseas during the tech boom that are gone and will never be back.
Right.
So in order for us to talk about raising revenue as well as cutting spending, we have to raise revenue in some fashion. And the president is saying, look, I get it. We don't want to raise everybody taxes. But it does make sense to raise the people taxes that have gained the most over the last two or three decades. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about raising taxes, it's only a fraction. When you look at the right. real actual number, but if you listen to the people talk, you would think they were raising these people taxes 20 to 30%. They're talking about fractions on the dollar. So I just don't understand. Well, I do understand. I understand that the GOP is a master at framing the conversation. They're a master at twisting and at spending anything that benefits them. And Democrats need to get better at that, because otherwise they're going to have the whole American people believing in what the GOP is saying because they have a better message. You said earlier that it's all about the language. Words matter, and GOP does a great job at it.
Oh, for sure. Like I said, they are the masters of communicating their message and changing the message. And so we go from a time in which we as a nation could have been not necessarily celebrating, but just a sense of peace and at ease that on whoseever watch that America was the better because of Osama bin Laden was no longer a part of our fear. Instead of us being able to breathe that in, we got to hear all of the, oh, he's spiking the ball and he's politicizing this and making it all be about the president, when we know without a shadow of a doubt, everybody knows it, if you have any umption in you, that if this was a Republican in office on when that happened, we wouldn't, it'd be so many commercials running about it, we would be sick. We know that. So I don't know how the people on TV let them get away with even framing that argument. But, you know, and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, they are the masters when it comes to putting things in rotation in the amount of times that you hear certain buzzwords.
Yeah.
You know, week, Jon Stewart just had like a five-minute segment on them saying he's spiking the ball from so many different people on so many different shows. It was like, are you serious? And so that must have been the email that went out, you know, say he's spiking the ball, and this is not a time to spike the ball. And I'd just be glad when the Democrats get just as savvy in how they frame their arguments as the Republicans are. And it's not so much that the Republicans are savvy. They just get on TV and just make up stuff and don't care.
But they
know it doesn't have any truth to it. But
they're
not in it to tell the truth. They're just in it to get a story out.
Yeah, you talked about that email goes out. That's literally a real email that goes out to these people. Says, here's your talking point for the day or for the week. And they use that. They use those key words very effectively. And the Democrats don't have a strategy.
Right, yeah.
Oh, so what would you say the president's biggest challenge between now and November? What's the one thing that he has to do without fault in order to ensure he gets the second term?
Well, it's a combination of things. We have to maintain peace with our adversaries, so we don't need to create problems with China, Mitt Romney, making up stuff. So we have to maintain some sort of, you know, civility with those that may not always agree. We have to continue doing what we're doing. He has to continue doing and fighting for the middle class as it relates to tax cuts, as it relates to the unemployment. You have some of those swing states whose unemployment rate is actually lower than the national rate. That's going to bode very well for him. When you look at Ohio, when you look at Pennsylvania, when you look at Michigan, some of their unemployment numbers, I know Ohio's and I know Pennsylvania's unemployment numbers are less than the national unemployment rate. So that speaks well, because that means his policies are working there, and they are direct beneficiaries of that, and those people hopefully will go out and vote. So, you know, it's those things, and we just, you know, it's funny because William Patrick was talking about they've been reading fables, and one of the fables they were reading was the tortoise and the hare. And so although the hare, by all counts, was faster and smarter and you know, was ahead and then started doing all these other things, it was the tortoise that just kept going, taking his time, but kept going, seeing that his end goal was the finish line. And that's the president. He might not move fast enough for me, or he may not say what I think he should have said to some people, you know, when, you know, when all was, when everything was going down, but he just kept going. And now he sits in a really good position. And although they come up with all these polls about it's neck and neck, no, it's not. That's their way of trying to convince people that this is not going to be a cakewalk. So once again, they're instilling fear in people. But I guarantee you, I believe at the end of the day, president will win. He will win hands down, and we might not even have to wait till 10 o'clock this time to get the results in, because people are going to be that motivated and excited based on what's going on in their own lives. When they take a look at the fact that they need to go out and vote, not just for the president, but to vote on that governor and to vote on those state Senate and House people in their state legislatures, that's what's going to get people out. Once people really understand that the pain and angst you're feeling in your state is much about your governor and the people in your capital more than it's about what's happening in D.C., that's what's going to be the difference. And that's the word that has to continue, that he has to figure out a way to get the state people to put out. And there's so many websites out there. I get tweets from every state about what the polling numbers are in that state, what the people are voting on in those legislators. So just go on your state's website and see what's happening. You'd be surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to shift now to sports. Now, every now and then, sports saturate the news. This week, Junior Seau left us, and I want to talk a little bit about what you think his death or the circumstances surrounding his death was all about.
Well, you know, there's been a lot lately talked about the amount of concussions that have happened in the NFL that has gone undetected, untreated, undiagnosed. And so it's interesting to hear that he made the comment. Someone asked him how many concussions did he have, and this was probably a couple of weeks ago, I believe someone stated he was having dinner with a friend. And he says, I have one, but it's never gone away. I've had a headache. You know, I've endured a headache ever since that first one. And so the fact that, you know, according to the report, that he shot himself not in the head but in the chest, these want to believe that he, too, wanted to have his brain researched, as the other guy did that killed himself a couple months back. From some of the same things, and to hear, I was watching. I want to say it was ESPN, and to hear, and there's a split in the football world as to whether or not concussions are that bad. Even those that are playing, you had Kurt Warner come out and say his kids will never play football. He's going to let them, and we know Kurt Warner has suffered a lot of concussions in his playing time. And so he's came out and said he really hopes his kids don't want to play football, because it's going to be real hard for him to let them do that, knowing how the system is set up, not just the NFL, but it starts, you know, in Pee Wee League, you know, the amount of times, you know, you start getting hit. So then
that's
he has
exactly
another
what I was
player.
Say. You know, people keep talking about the fact that is how many hits you're taking in the NFL. The reality is it starts when you're, you know, down there. And you get those hits year in and year out, year over, you know, preseason and spring training and in the season and at postseason. And so, yeah, it's a lot more than people are saying with just the league, right?
Right. And it's more than just a one-time thing. It's the players who sometimes, you know, will force the team doctor's hand not to say I got a concussion. Let me, whatever. Because the amount of money that's attached to it. I mean, I go back to that scene of Any Given Sunday and Lawrence Taylor's character, and he was guaranteed a $1 million bonus if he sacked somebody or did, you know, whatever he did. and he goes out on the stretcher, and he's talking about, did I stop him? Because he knew it, in that game, if he had done it, he was going to get that million-dollar bonus.
Exactly.
And he is laid out on the stretcher, strapped down. And he's so you look at the fact that all these things that might be included in their contracts, you know, that if they miss so many games, they might lose this amount. And so we don't really know all the inner workings, but what we do know is that you have well over 1,500 current and past players who are suing the NFL because they have not provided them with the right information as it relates to concussions, what the long-term effects are. And so that's something that the commissioner is going to have to really take a hard look at.
So what would the football game of football be without that vicious, ferocious hits that we all just, you know, long to see? I mean, to be honest, I mean, people go watch the game for those big hits.
Yeah, but I think I don't think it's just the big hit. I think it's the big hit five times during the game. You know, probably that first big hit you should go out as opposed to shaking it off and getting up and continue playing. When does the player say, I'm not going back in, regardless of what the coaches say? When does the coach say, you're not going back in, regardless of what the player says, you know? So, you know, there's culpability and accountability issues on both sides, because at the end of the day, we know people are make the kind of money being on the field. You don't make that kind of money, that, you know, sitting on the sideline in your warm-up. You know, things happen. You lose endorsements that way.
And then
there's a whole lot that's attached to it.
Right, then you go and see something like the New Orleans Saints. They get in trouble for literally telling people to go out there and hurt people.
Right.
So I mean, so you got the fact that it's already bad enough that they're in the game and getting hit. Then you got people intentionally going out trying to hurt people. On top of that, the game is not like it used to be.
Right. But the sad part about it is those types of issues have gone on for years. And so the fact that the NFL has failed, according to the players, to really hold the opposing team players accountable and or provide the right amount of education to the players about the risk, about what you need to do, the NFL has some culpability as well. I think, you know, that there might need to be an independent body, not a body of doctors that's attached to the NFL.
Yeah. That's right.
There should
be
an independent group of neurosurgeons or whatever, to do a study, and then let's talk about what they say and come up with some suggestions based on that.
Now, you talked earlier about the money. Obviously, money plays a major role into what players do and what kind of decisions they make, even though they're going to put their body in harm's way. But it's sad to see that, you know, even though several years after they get out of the NFL, they're almost destitute, broke again. What's going on if they're making all this money and then all of a sudden 5 years after they get out, they're still in a dire situation?
That's I don't know. I mean, that's the I don't know. I really don't.
I mean, here we are, you know, putting yourself in harm's way day in and day out for all of this money, but yet and still, you know, weeks, months, years after you get out of the league, here you are in a situation where you can't pay your mortgage, or you're filing for bankruptcy, or, you know, you're just in a destitute situation. Or you end up getting divorced, or your wife leaves you because you're not making the kind of money, you know. It just all kind of things happen that leads me to believe that money is, they're chasing that money for those reasons. So, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, for sure, that's exactly what I would agree with you on that. They stay in it longer than they should, and they put their bodies through all sorts of abuse longer than they should, and then, you know, there's not a lot of good planning for the day football is over. I mean, the stories are, as you alluded to, a greater of those that didn't plan than for those that did. And that's the unfortunate truth.
All right, we're going to go to the phone lines right now. We're going to go to the caller last four, 5764. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, Patrick. My name is William Phillips. I'm a friend of your wife, Jima. I just want to commend you on the subject matter today. In regards to the NFL players, I think the last caller alluded to it, that the primary basis for the things that the professional athletes endure is due to the fact that they lack longevity. Another significant factor that no one really brings about is the fact that a vast majority of professional athletes, in most instances, they don't secure their education, so they don't have a basis or fallback for alternative employment. Once they finish playing professional sports, they make significant, extravagant sums of money, and unfortunately, even the ones that make significant funds, statistics bear out that 75% of the NFL players within a four-year time period after they leave the game are filing for bankruptcy, or there's other things that they're dealing with in regards to, you know, loss of employment. The NFL makes exorbitant sums of money, and, you know, it's a mockery to sit here and for them to say that they're concerned about the long-term well-being, and you hear all these horror stories of former players having to file federal lawsuits for disability entitlements, and the NFL is a multi-billion-dollar corporation to where they're making all these exorbitant sums of money, yet there's documented proof of the ramifications of concussions and other injuries that the players sustain that hinder them from life. And unlike most people, if you sustain a significant injury on your job, there's a legitimate means of recourse. But in the NFL, because they have a collective bargaining agreement and the way it's structured, there's a committee set up that by the NFL that determines who gets disability, and they have all these experts and doctors that in a lot of instances deny legitimate disability claims.
Wow. So William, first of all, thank you for your call. I wonder why then, when you have a situation like the NFL lockout and the Players Association, they go through these negotiations and they say, well, you know, we're not going to play until we come to this agreement. Why do you think then they don't include these health benefits to the degree that they know they need them in these negotiations?
Because they're, for the vast majority of them, because they, like I said, the average career span is only limited of 4 years, they don't see tomorrow. They don't. They look at the short-term instant gratification of, okay, I may have a limited time to play. I need to make as much money as I can within that designated time frame or window. And then secondly, in regards to the impetus for your question of why they don't, I think, and this is just my own opinion, some of the people that are at the negotiating table are just really not qualified to be in that position. You have a contingency of what they call NFL player representatives, and you may have someone who is the head of the NFLPA who is a lawyer, and you have people acting out of their element, people that, you know, have a significant interest in the long-term health care but in benefit to that, but they don't really are really not abreast of the issue. So they, in my opinion, if I were playing in the NFL, I would have someone, you know, a representative that's familiar with those type of issues that, who would be able to negotiate on my behalf, because those are legitimate concerns. But a lot of time I think the NFL, and it's a similar situation in the NBA, and just not as pervasive or bad, is that they have these players, and they're playing in an arena, Patrick, that they're not really familiar with. You know what I mean?
Wow. Yeah,
I mean, they're just not informed. It's you're out of your element, so subsequently they get taken advantage of.
Wow. Well, awesome, William. Thank you for your call. We really appreciate you chiming in.
All right, but stay blessed, my brother.
You too. So, Jim, so what do you think about because of these occurrences happening so frequently over the last few years, do you think now going forward that they would have the right representation, A and B? This is something that somebody will really take a serious look at from this point forward.
Well, I think the only way, as I stated or alluded to earlier, that the only way I think that the NFL will really take a real good look is if they have a body that is that will investigate and research this, that is detached from the NFL itself, an independent body of neurosurgeons, of doctors or researchers that will begin to offer an unbiased where they're not connected to the NFL in any sort. As a matter of fact, I think they should be secret. Nobody should even know who they are, like the Navy SEALs, you know. Just, you know, somebody somewhere gets this
right.
together. And they go out and they do it so that we know they won't be tainted or they won't be bought off. They won't be given, you know, free season tickets to whatever team. I mean, you know, we need somebody that is a truly independent that can provide the insight to the players and to the owners, Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, as the caller was stating, you know, someone is you know, the player has to own up to the fact your time in the league is limited. But everybody thinks I'm not going to be that one. So everybody on the team thinks they're not the one, when in reality, more than half of you all will be the one.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the hardcore truth of the matter. And so they have to begin to really look at you know, 5 years out, and what am I going to do 5 years out? What am I going to do? How am I going to maintain my level of lifestyle that I've grown accustomed to, and when I'm no longer making $10 million a year? So I mean, how do you do that? You know, how do you downsize from 10 million to no million? You know, what do you have? You know, how many clubs, car washes, restaurants are you going to invest in order for you to be able to maintain the lifestyle that you're accustomed to? So you really, I mean, they got to put some thought into it. They got to put, you know, some energy into it. And the NFL has to do a much better job, I feel, of educating. The doctors on staff cannot be in the pockets of the owners or in the pockets of the players. They've got to be thinking about their medical career and what they say do no harm. And when you allow a player to go out and play when he shouldn't, when you allow an owner to push a player back out on the field when he's not completely ready, then that doctor, in my opinion, you know, it should be held liable and accountable as well. So
I definitely agree. All right, so we're closing down on the last segment of the show. I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your life class segment.
Oh, my goodness, this is too much. I don't have enough time. But what I will say is that the finale was this past Monday, and I haven't had an opportunity to review that yet. But I looked at the one from the week before when she had all four of the people on stage, and that would be Ayanla Vanzant, Tony Robbins, Bishop T.D. Jakes, and Deepak Chopra. They were all there, and they were excellent. And they talked about forgiveness. And one of the things that Bishop said that really resonated with me is that, and he said, you're expecting people to give you something or to love you on a gallon level when they are pint people.
Mm.
That's deep.
Elaborate.
So I'm expecting great things, right? I'm expecting a gallon. We all know a gallon is more than a pint, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So if a gallon is more than a pint, I can't keep associating with people who got pint-sized thinking. I got to be around people that got gallon-sized thinking because those are the people that think like me.
Right,
because
right.
If I don't, I'll find myself thinking like a pint-sized person
right.
as opposed to a gallon person.
Being sucked in by that. Mm-hmm.
Being sucked in to the smallness. When I see me, great. I see me on the stage. You see me in your living room. You know what I'm saying? So,
right, right.
So you've got to begin to associate with people that think like you. That's not to say you're better than the pint people's thinking, but I'm a gallon thinking person, so I cannot continue to be around people that think in the pint size because that's smaller than where I am.
Right.
That was so profound to me, and it was so simple. It's so simple. And so, as I stated, I go into some more next week because I will have watched the final, and I know she talked about gratitude, and one of the things that she said is that every day you should write down five things that you're grateful for. And it doesn't have to be anything extravagant, but just five things that you're grateful for. And you will every day you wake up and think about, I'm going to be, you know, five things I'm going to be grateful for. Then you begin to look for those things. As opposed to looking for what you don't have, you begin to look for the things that you do have and the things that you're grateful for.
Right,
and because
right.
of that,
I like it. Mm-hmm.
You know, you always end up with more than what you need because you're already thankful for what you have.
Right, right. That's awesome. All right, give me your final thoughts for today.
Final thoughts for today is register to vote. People, please go out and register. You know, Reverend Jesse said yesterday on Rainbow Push that there's over 10 million people that are not registered to vote. What we fail to realize is that our registering to vote is the ones that puts us in that jury box. So when there's that jury, when we dealing with the case in Florida, there should be people that's in Florida that look like Marissa and not that look like everybody else. But if we're not registered, they're not going to call us up for jury duty. You know, we're not going to be able to vote on the judges that are elected to sit on these appellate courts and things of that nature. We get to vote on that, but if you're not registered, then you don't have that opportunity to do that. So registering to vote and then actually going out to vote is so important. It's not just about reelecting President Obama. It's about ensuring what's happening in your state is a benefit to you and that it's an asset to you and it's not taken away from you. So my final thoughts is just please go out and register to vote. It is very, very, very important.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. Now, don't forget to follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima, AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE TalkRadio.blogspot.com. And stay tuned. Next week, we're going to be talking all politics. We're going to define some terms, talk about the GOP platform, the Democratic platform, all those things you need to be ready to get in that voting booth. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Take us away, Joyce.